All right, brethren and sisters, you recall, those of you who were here last night, that we ended on a note of dealing with the emphasis on the necessity for a speaker, be he an exhorter, presider, or lecturer, to develop and maintain a keen sense of communication. That's where we stopped. I don't believe that there are any here tonight that weren't here last night. If so, would you please raise your hand? One. Well, you'll have to pick it up from where we left off, because we can't retrace all the steps, as you can well imagine. But that's where we stopped last night. We were dealing with the speaker's responsibility to respond or read his audience. Now, that is a basic fundamental principle of public speaking. I don't care what the arena is, whether it's an ecclesia in terms of a Bible class, whether it's a class session like those that we've been having here at Bible school, whether it's an exhortive context or a public lecture. It's an absolute essential that the speaker make every effort to read his audience. Now, I'm not going to stand up here in front of you, brethren, and suggest to you that that's something that you can acquire overnight. But there's such a doctrine that I choose to term of awareness. If a brother, whatever his age, and this is particularly true of the younger brethren, if they are aware of elements to look for, of techniques to be aware of, these things become almost second nature in some respect. There's a danger there, too, for those of us who are older and, quote, more experienced, unquote. We quite often will fall into habits because we assume that by virtue of our experience and exposure, or a combination of the two, that everything is going to be automatic. Not so. I've been speaking, one way or another, for the better part of 40 years. And I find myself, when I take time to remind myself, that I'm making certain mistakes that I shouldn't be making. And most of them are the result of assuming that I've got it made. Now, that doesn't mean that you cannot acquire a lot of it and hold on to it in a subliminal way. But I'm saying this for the benefit of the older brethren. Never make the decision internally that we do not have to concern ourselves with this basic underlying principle, that we must do everything in our power to gain and maintain a sense of communication with those to whom we are talking. And we do that by reading them. Reading them. You don't look off into space, you look right at them, but more about that in a moment. Now, a speaker's bodily activity, and I mean physical bodily activity, on the platform must promote effective communication. Effective communication of the ideas that he is trying to put over, not to distract from them. Now, let that sink in for just a moment. A speaker's bodily activity must be designed to enhance the putting over of the idea, not to distract from it. There's absolutely no place, brethren and sister wives, if you're going to be your husband's best critics, and they usually are. I see a couple of them smiling back there. I know it's gone on, all right? And that's fine. That's a perfect alter critic posture, by the way, Brother Jim. And don't knock it, as they would say in the current vernacular. There's no place in a speaker's bodily activity for a false or manufactured gesture, for example. And yet you'll see some who will do that. We had a brother some years ago in Washington, and bless his heart, tremendous hard worker. But he knew that he had to work on his speaking ability, and he knew the value of certain gestures. But that brother would come up to a point and he'd stop and he'd say, "Now, that's it." Well, everybody expected him to come up and say, "Now, that's it." It was a manufactured gesture, a bodily activity that distracted. People were waiting for him to do it. You understand what I'm saying? Instead of paying attention and having that bodily activity bring the force of the idea over. In other words, gestures, and we'll talk about those, gestures must be genuine and they must be spontaneous. They're no good if they're not. And it's part of your bodily activity, and it can make or break the ability of your hearers, whoever they are, young or old, to grasp the very point that you're orally trying to put over to them. However, learning to be bodily expressive, and there's nothing wrong with that, learning to be bodily expressive on the platform requires discipline of gesture. What might be a natural exchange between a Brother Ray and me, let's say in the dining hall, a one-on-one conversation, and Ray may take his finger and jab me right here, you know, I'll back up and say, "Hey, whoa!" Like that kind of gesture is not necessarily what you might do in a spontaneous gesture from the platform. We can be carried away by such things. They're very effective when properly used and spontaneous. But we must never get ourselves or permit ourselves to get into a situation where we are overly conversational, such as it would be on a one-on-one basis. It's an excellent thought because it enhances communication. When you think about that, that's all public speaking is, as I said last night. It's an enlarged conversation. It's a systematic discourse. And thinking of it that way sometimes helps stage fright, which we'll get to in just a moment. The two things in this particular area that are quite important that I'd like to mention right now. First of all, handling one's body as a speaker or a presider or a teacher, whether you're sitting down or standing up. And by the way, 9 times out of 10, you'll be standing up. And probably 99 times out of 100, you should be standing up, just on the side. Handling one's body so as not to inhibit action is absolutely important. That's what I was alluding to briefly last night when I talked about the microphone situation with Brother Tom and Brother Bob. Through no fault of their own, their bodily reaction was to be locked in for just a couple of moments to that mic. Bad. Your bodily action has got to release you from a freezed position. Quite often, and this is just a little aside, but quite often, brethren, particularly in their neophyte approach to speaking, and it's natural, will grab hold of the lectern or the stand. And if you happen to be sitting in the front row, brothers and sisters, you can see those knuckles begin to turn white. They're freezing. They're holding onto that thing so that it becomes a crutch. And before you know it, that impacts on the speaker's ability to do his job correctly. It almost becomes a burden. How do I break it? He begins to think about how do I break it rather than to enhance what he's trying to pass on to his audience. And all of a sudden, you know, if they break loose, maybe the whole idea structure will break down. I've seen that happen. I have seen a brother, and this is not hypercriticism. Remember what I said last night. We're going to be quite blunt about this. I've seen a brother freeze at a platform in terms of a rigidness, and he was going on with a monotone, and I could see it almost in his eyes. He knew he had to break that structure. And when he finally broke it, he lost his train of thought. He had to stop talking. He was reading from a manuscript, and he lost his place in the manuscript. It was very embarrassing to him, obviously, and to his audience. One thing you've got to avoid is getting yourself bodily into a frozen position. It's got to be loose enough. If you're aware of this mentally, it helps. It's got to be loose enough that you can respond to an impulse respond to an impulse. Your body itself can become an enhancing gesture. There's something else while we're on this particular point. Bodily activity deals with what one does not only with one's eyes and hands and arms, but one's legs. I think last night I did this. Terrible. Keys, change. If you have to do something with that hand to keep it busy, put it behind you. Don't ever put it in your pocket. Do you hear me? Don't ever put your hand in your pocket. Another easy thing to do that you must avoid at all costs . Every once in a while, you'll find a brother pull a handkerchief out and do this. Well, if you're in Florida, you can understand that, particularly this time of the year. But what you do with your hands around your head is one of the most distracting things possible to an audience. If you have that inclination to raise that hand, well, all right, do this if you want to. You know, put it on your lapel. But don't grab your neck, don't rub your nose, don't rub your chin, unless that's a gesture with an absolute meaning. Don't do it. In other words, work at not doing things like that. Scratching your ear. We had one brother, bless his heart again, who was always taking the collar, you know, of his shirt like that. People began to watch him do this and missed entirely the points he was making. It was just a nervous habit. A nervous habit. Speaker must be aware of little things like that by the dozens that might make quite a difference in terms of his effectiveness. Now, as I suggested last night, some of the elements that we will address will be old hat to some of you, considered mundane possibly by some of you, but nonetheless important, particularly for a newer speaker, but certainly important for a reminder of those who've been in the business for a few years. There are three different modes of delivery of an exhortation, a Bible class, or a lecture. I'm simply referring to the written mode, the extemporaneous mode, and the impromptu mode. The written, extemporaneous, and impromptu. Now, we all know what the written mode is. It means that we have produced a manuscript that we're using. But how many of you know really what an extemporaneous speech, exhortation, or lecture is? Do you realize, for example, brethren and sisters, that the three teachers we have here this year at Bible school are all using the extemporaneous mode? How they're going to say something is not practiced and memorized ahead of time any more than what I'm doing right now. I'm using the extemporaneous mode now. I have my notes in front of me, but the way I'm going to express things is not something that I've memorized. But it calls for an orderly, systematic development of your notes, and then your personality and amplification on the spur of the moment coming from that. That's extemporaneous. Impromptu, on the other hand, is what most presiding brethren are faced with. Impromptu means that you have absolutely no notes. You are going to express yourself prayerfully and hopefully after thinking about it, but sometimes a very brief thought process. You're going to express yourself on your feet in an appropriate context before an exhortation, before and during the announcements, and certainly as you prepare the memorials and eventually close the meeting. Now, that doesn't mean you might not have a register of events in front of you, but your expression is totally impromptu, almost without exception. So you understand the three different modes. All right? We'll come back to those in due course. Now, we will attack the very first thing that comes in the mind of a new speaker. Well, there are rare exceptions to this and some aberrations, but almost without exception, one thing that invariably impinges on a new speaker, and sometimes those of many years' experience, is stage fright. Ever hear of the term stage fright? How many of you have ever experienced what you think is stage fright? Well, an honest audience. It's a human reaction. Now, how do you deal with it? How do you deal with it? You see, stage fright can get in the way, particularly for beginners, of free mental and bodily activity. It absolutely can stymie it. Now, there are things that can be done, good things that can be done to either minimize, to combat, and possibly even eliminate stage fright. Stage fright can be attacked in any or all of at least three ways. Now, think about this, because we're going to get into some psychological elements. And there's nothing wrong with psychology when applied honestly. It can be attacked in one or all of three ways. First of all, minimize the danger aspect of the situation. Now, what in the world am I talking about? Minimize the danger aspect of the situation. Dispel the idea, in other words, purge it, dispel the idea that danger can be met only by retreating or running away. Get it out of your mind. You may experience stage fright. Nothing wrong with that. It's an honest human reaction. But get the idea out of your mind that the way to handle it is to retreat or run away from it. Don't run away from it. Now, how do you minimize stage fright? How do you go about this? First of all, as a potential or practicing speaker, you must recognize that public speaking does not differ all that much from speaking in private. Now, remember the example I gave you last night of the young brother who was a horrible speaker, who became a good speaker and now is a very good speaker? This is exactly the principle that was applied to that young man. He's no longer a young man. But he was made to understand that, look, you can carry on a conversation with an individual. If you can do that, you can be an exhorting brother. And we worked on that principle. It's not all that different. It's just an enlarged conversation. That's what public speaking is. It's an enlarged conversation. You know, grabbing this notion often helps make public speaking less formidable and associates it with what you may already do very well. You may converse with your wife or your children or your brothers or your sisters on a one-on-one or small group very well. So if you think about it, gee, I can carry on a conversation with Uncle Harry. No problem talking about golf or what we had for breakfast or whether I had a good night's sleep last night. I can do that. If I can do that, then I can learn to speak publicly. I can learn to exhort. I don't have to let the stage fright control me. I can control it. Thorough preparation, believe it or not, is one of the best things to overwhelm potential stage fright. Thorough preparation. When a person does this, They're psychologically ready to meet the difficult situation. You know what you're going to do. You know what you're going to say. Gil, this is exactly what we were expressing just last evening, I guess it was. If a speaker, however inexperienced he may be, prepares thoroughly for the task that he has, he is in command. He's got to tell himself that. He's in command. He knows exactly what he's going to say, and he knows how he's going to say it, and why he's going to say it, and to whom he's going to say it. So there's no reason why he should be afraid to get up and say it. It's overwhelmed the potential of stage fright. He knows, his audience doesn't. And when you convince yourself of that, and it's a truism, I'm not suggesting a falsehood to you, it's a truism. When you understand that mentally, what you've done is put yourself in a posture. Stay. You see, brethren and sisters, and I'm sure some of you are aware of this, maybe all of you are, it's a well-known physiological fact, as well as a psychological fact, that the human being, and that we all are, we know that we're mortal flesh, can not experience two emotions at the same time. If you didn't know that before, you now know it. I just told you. It's a fact. You cannot experience two emotions at the same time. They cannot be simultaneously experienced. So if we replace stage fright with another emotion, we've purged stage fright. Simple examples. If you've prepared thoroughly in terms of what you're going to have to do and what you're going to say, you can tell yourself. How many of you talk to yourselves? I talk to myself. Let's be honest about it. Sure, we do. Talk to yourself and say, look, I have a great idea. I have a great point of exhortation, and I want my brothers and sisters to understand it. I can hardly wait to get up there and tell them. I have developed this to a point where I think it's going to be semi-revolutionary in their thinking. I'm being extreme here to make a point. But the point of the matter is this. If we talk to ourselves, knowing full well that we're thoroughly prepared, and find ourselves chafing at the bit, stage fright is history. So if you're worried about stage fright, think about these little items that we're just briefly touching on. Very, very effective. Very effective. Other things that are small but effective. That's precisely why I brought this chair out here. You see, your bodily activity as well as your mental state, your mindset, before you are called upon to speak, or before a meeting starts if you're the presider, is very important and very helpful. For example, get set bodily. Our presider this past Sunday, I know it dawned on him. He was not bodily set to begin with. Now the only reason, brethren, and here again, this is for constructive purposes. The only reason I was very conscious of this was because I knew that the committee had asked me to give a series of classes. So I was alert to this kind of thing. He was not bodily set Sunday. What he was doing, and this is the presider, was this. How many of you noticed? All right, you see, I wasn't by myself. But it dawned on him. It dawned on him. And he became bodily set before too many minutes passed. If you notice Brother Harry last night in his prior to his exhortive lecture, he had his legs carefully crossed at the ankles. Not this. although that can be acceptable under certain circumstances. But he had his legs casually crossed at the ankles. When you are preparing yourself, knowing that you're going to be called on shortly, whether it's a prayer even, if you're on the platform, lean forward just slightly. Lean forward just slightly. Take a couple or three deep breaths. If you can get away with it, and this is something you've got to be careful of, have a suppressed yawn. You'd be surprised what that does for you. It clears that canal. You don't get up there and all, you're ready to be very positive in terms of your expression. But lean forward, and when you go to the stand, don't do it in a rather casual way, unless the situation calls for it. If you're dealing with certain classes of youngsters, maybe that kind of expression is valuable, but not in terms of the exhortation or the lecture. That doesn't mean you run to the podium, but you stride up there with purpose, with purpose. And get yourself set before you open your mouth. And one of the best things for your diaphragm is to let those shoulders sag once you get up there. Just sort of, you know, let them drop. And then look at your audience. Look them right in the eye. Before you even open your mouth. I don't mean for 5 or 10 seconds. What I'm saying is that you, as a public speaker, exhorter, lecturer, are preparing yourself the most effective way to be effective for your hearers. When you do open your mouth, you are in a relaxed or semi-relaxed posture. You have already convinced yourself that you're in command, you're breathing right, you've looked your audience in the face, and you've got them waiting. Then you open your mouth. That's bodily action. Simple, rational, bodily action, if you're aware of it, will make you a far better and more effective speaker, whatever status we find ourselves in. You know, when you first start speaking, and this has to be carefully handled, but when you first start speaking, it's a good idea to take a step or two, either to the left or the right. Much more than you might do later on while you're speaking, particularly if you're tied to a manuscript, and we will get to that in due course. But even if you're tied to a manuscript, what that does is two things, at least two things. It tends to enhance your own comfort if you've stepped a step or two, not backwards, never backwards, possibly sideways, or if the stand is such as it is in a number of our halls, where you can actually step around, take a step forward beside the stand on either side, do it. It has a fantastic impact on your own well-being and gets you running at a fast start. But it also rivets your audience. Yes, as opposed to the statue. Big difference. This morning I'm going to have a few things I'd like to share with you. That took what, 2 seconds? Small, but very important for your own mental mindset and the way you've got your audience. I'll never forget, as long as I am rationally given the strength to remember it, the first visit we had from a well-known English brother, and I will use him on a positive and a negative expression. The brother was ill. We had never seen him before. It was in the mid-50s. It was 31 years ago, to be exact. It was 1955. He was met at the railroad station in Washington then. Ill, we didn't know it until we met him. He was sick, sick, sick. But he was going to fulfill his lecture appointment in our meeting hall that night. He couldn't eat because he was ill. He was brought to the meeting hall by our recording brother. He got there just 5 minutes before the meeting was to start, and because he was an English visitor back when they were rare in the mid-50s, we had a full hall, not only in terms of our own members, but visitors from Baltimore and neighbors. I was scheduled to preside that night. I hadn't even seen the brother, never met him. I knew his name, I knew his reputation, but I never met him. Well, I was a little antsy, to use the common term. And that's one reason I'll never forget what happened. I met him, I was told he was ill. I said, "Can you go on, brother?" Blank. And he says, "I will go on." And after having heard a hello and "I will go on," that's all I heard from him, in a rather weak voice. So, all right, we opened the meeting with a hymn, a prayer. I gave the reading. I introduced this brother and sat down. This little diminutive creature got up. And it's as if the Queen of England were to walk in that door right now. What would you do? I'm telling you, brothers and sisters, head snapped, knees flapped together. You could almost hear the toes jumping. That place fell into dead silence after an immediate arresting point. I'll never forget it as long as I live. And then for the next 45 or 50 minutes, that brother had everybody spellbound if they could understand him. But more about that later on, too. But the point I'm trying to make by using that illustration is that as ill as that brother was, he commanded the situation by using this technique. That's what I'm trying to pass on to you. All right? Are there any questions or observations at this stage of the game that any of you would like to raise? Yes, Larry.
We only have a mic that's on that platform. If you walk away from it, you lose the volume. You lose what the speaker says to some of the older brothers.
That's correct, and you've got to be very careful. Brother Harry has made a very good point. If you've got a stationary mic, you've got to be very careful. What that does is restrict the circle, the circumference that you can move in, Larry. Harry, that's why I said if your platform or your podium is such that you can step beside it, you have not lost that. If you are aware that there's a fixed mic there, then when you step to the side, you can just turn your head maybe 15 degrees. You can do that unobtrusively so that your voice goes toward that mic. In Washington, we have our mic piped into the basement, particularly for the communion service, because the table's down in front of the platform. So we turn the mic around. The presiding brother is aware that that mic is used for downstairs. So he tries to, in an unobtrusive way, cast his vocal tones toward the microphone. It's not as effective as we'd like it. We have both the neck mic and the fixed mic. The fixed mic, however, is necessary for the amplifiers downstairs. But your point is well taken. Again, the speaker's got to be aware of that. If he has a limited circumference to work with, he knows that and limits himself to it. But it doesn't stop him from making that motion. Instead of making maybe taking two or three steps, it only takes a step and a half, things of that nature. All right? Now let's deal with a few helps in general. And this applies, I think, to all of us, young, old, or in between. We must always, and this is particularly true in the truth, we must always try to speak on a subject which is interesting to us. Now let me amplify that by restating it in other words. An exhorter or a lecturer, if and when he has the choice, and he almost invariably does as an exhorter, must select a subject in which he is interested. This automatically, brethren, brings a genuineness to what you're saying and how you say it that you will never get if somebody else selects the subject for you. Now, when it comes to lectures, it's a different ball game. Obviously, when a brother is invited quite often to lecture at a given meeting or for a given area, he may be given a subject or a series of subjects by the host ecclesia. And that's all right. However, the content of that lecture, germane to the subject matter, the approach can be selected by you. What interests you in terms of a particular subject? Now, let me give you an illustration. The ASK, the Mid-Atlantic ASK, is now sponsoring a series of lectures on peace and safety, then cometh sudden destruction. You've all heard of it, because this is the year that's been declared by the United Nations of peace and safety. Three brethren, Brother John Bolello, Brother Ron Hicks, and myself, have been identified as the brethren who are available for that particular lecture in the 16 or 17 Mid-Atlantic ecclesias. If you ever were a wagering person, and I'm not suggesting you do this, but if you were ever a wagering person, you could wager that Brother Hicks and Brother Bolello and Brother Butts would attack that subject differently. Do you understand what I'm saying? The subject would be given to us, but the way we would treat it would be that which we were most interested in, because what that does is highlight and enhance the genuineness of the way we would treat it. Now, you multiply that by a factor of 100 or 1,000, and it's very, very important, particularly to the exhorting brother, that he select a subject of genuine interest to himself, because it makes all the difference in the world as to how effectively you can deal with it. Now, in that connection, there is an absolute gilt-edged axiom with respect to public speaking. It consists of three old rules. Does anybody know what those three old rules are? Anybody? Well, I'll tell you what they are. They're practice, practice, Pete, and practice. Practice, practice, practice. Did you have a question, Brother Pete? Well, probably what you were going to guess was reasonably right, but those are the three old rules. There is no substitute for it. Absolutely not. I don't care whether you're dealing extemporaneously or from a manuscript, and we'll enlarge that in due course. For example, rehearse aloud. Brother Ray, do you rehearse aloud? Excellent answer. Sometimes. And that's exactly the answer I would give. Other times, due to, quote, degree of experience, no. But sometimes, yes. But you see, what Brother Ray and Brother X and Brother Y and Brother Bill would have to do is to make a judgment of whether that rehearsing aloud will enhance what we're going to do at a given time. We will make that mental judgment. And if the judgment is that that rehearsing aloud is going to help because of our experience, we will do it. Do you understand what I'm saying? If you are a neophyte and starting out, don't ever disdain rehearsing aloud. This is particularly true, brethren, if you use a manuscript. And a lot of our brethren do. If you use a manuscript, there is absolutely no substitute for rehearsing aloud. You can sit in the quiet of your room and read it a dozen times, and it won't do you nearly as much good as one session in front of a mirror bouncing noise off the wall. Some years ago, Brother Harry Tennant was a guest in my home, and I offered a room for him to take a nap, and he took it. And before long, I heard this rumbling coming out of the room. Yes, you're right. It was a Brother Harry Tennant rehearsing aloud. So don't disdain it. Don't be afraid to do it. It's a very valid point. If you are an extemporaneous speaker, and those who will matriculate from manuscript to extemporaneous, meaning getting away from a manuscript, beginning to use notes, and that happens, and that's a good progression, does not mean for a moment that you should start rehearsing any part of it until you've completed your outline. Now that's easy enough when you have a manuscript to follow, because you've got to have the document in front of you before you can rehearse it. But it's not so easy to discipline yourself if you're extemporaneous. You've got a series of notes and you're beginning to put them in an outline form, you know, A follows Z, and B follows A, and so on. And you tend to, well, now this is what I'm going to think about. Don't do it. Don't do it. Put your whole outline down before you then begin to put the microscope on in terms of the way you intend to handle it, even in an extemporaneous context. Now, that's pretty hard to do. It requires discipline. I'm speaking personally when I say that. I tend to have an idea put down, and I'll mentally expand that idea. This is the way I want to handle it before I have really and sincerely addressed the conclusion that I want to come from this whole series of ideas. And that's a mistake. And I have to stop myself. I have to discipline myself not to do that. So all I'm telling you is, don't do it. Put it down. Yes, Gar. Why? Because you'll be disjointed. You will be circumferential in your treatment quite often. You will cost yourself time, Gar, in terms of the orderly process. Now, that doesn't mean it can't happen. I don't want to leave you with the impression that a good product can't come out of it. I'm trying to enhance the way it's more effectively and quickly done. Because if we find ourselves going around in circles, and I've done it, I've found myself doing it, I'm sure you have too, in terms of mentally expanding a point, not really knowing how many will follow it or what should precede it, we find ourselves tending to go over old ground and possibly being unnecessarily redundant. That's the kind of point I'm driving at. That doesn't mean that something can't come out of it in a productive way, but it's better to get it all down first and in an orderly way before you then begin to rehearse how you're going to handle those notes. That's really what I was saying. I think this is a truism without question. When you rehearse, whether you're talking a manuscript or extemporaneous, try to find a place where you will not be interrupted. Now, I know all of us, not all of us, but most of us have had, and maybe all of us, from time to time, children or grandchildren bouncing about the house. I'm seeing a brother here who I know has children bouncing about the house. Where do you go to prepare your recitations? How do you get away, the brother from Rochester? How do you get away? And close the door. And you tell those children not to bother you. Hard to do, isn't it? Peace. I'm glad he said that and not me. But the point is, and it's a simple thing, we all know that. But if you can get in an uninterrupted state somewhere, and I know this brother has a number of children, that's why I said that, it makes a difference. It gets right back, Gar, to the point we were making just a moment ago. Anything that makes us tend to go in circles, however well-intended, is going to cost us time and possibly cost an orderly representation. Yes, Harry?
Whatever, order, brother. You just go to the Ecclesia Hall itself.
It's a very good thing to do. I've done it many, many times. Excellent suggestion. If you're within, I'm almost an hour away from the Ecclesial Hall, but I still, on occasion, will go over there, particularly if it's a very sensitive lecture. We had a lecture in Washington some years ago. Brother Chuck, I don't know whether you were still there or not. We had a series of three lectures in terms of the Arab in you, the Jew in you, and, I mean, the Arab in Christ, the Jew in Christ, and you in Christ. Well, when we published the advertisement for the first one, which was the Arab in Christ, do you know we had 18 Muslims enter that hall? Now, the brother who gave that particular lecture, I see a couple back here from Baltimore. Were you there, you brethren? I know both of you were. Brother Gene Turner was the one who had been given the assignment of that particular lecture. Well, Gene was an excellent selection for that. But I can tell you that in that particular thing, Gene was concerned, and rightly so, about how that would happen. Because when you give lectures like that in the city of Washington, anything can happen. Anything. We almost invariably have strangers of some form in our lectures. So that, Harry, is a very valid point when you're dealing with a sensitive element, even an exhortation, but when you're dealing with a sensitive element, that's a good place to go. Go to the place you're going to give it and work on it. And you're apt not to be interrupted there. One or two more points before we bring the session tonight to a close. It is imperative that a speaking brother develop, if I may use the word, cultivate, and it can be done, develop or cultivate the desire to speak to your audience. We happen to have 14 speaking brethren in Washington. Detroit, I guess, has what, 30 or 40? How many do you have? Quite a few. Now that's an exceptional, I mean, Detroit's a large ecclesia. And to have that many speaking brethren is a plus to those who are a little concerned about carrying out a responsibility. When we have 14, we feel we're blessed. I know what Brother Bob has got to worry about in the small ecclesia in Sarasota. What am I driving at? Among the brethren who have speaking assignments in our ecclesia, I'm not currently aware of a single one who dreads the assignment. It's not always been the case. Because we have tried to inculcate, particularly into our younger brethren. In fact, we have two that are not on the speaking list right now who are just champing at the bit to get on it. And they will be put on it, God willing, before this year is out. We tried to inculcate in them the thought process to have the desire to speak to the brethren and the sisters. And what does that do? It almost automatically eliminates stage fright, not all of it, but it gets a lot of it out of there. But it automatically enhances the quality, not only of the message, but the way the message is delivered. And remember what we said last night, you can't divorce one from the other. You may have a worthwhile thing to say, but if you say it in a lousy way, it's going to be ineffective. If you're smooth as glass and don't have anything worthwhile to say, nothing. It's a combination of the two. So when you can cultivate in yourself your own mindset, speaking to the young brethren now, maybe the older ones who view this assignment as a tough thing to do. Work on your own internal desire to share with your brothers and sisters exhortive thoughts. And you'd be surprised. And we're going to get to note-taking and how we accumulate data before we're through. Not tonight, but before we're through. But you'd be surprised how that database begins to multiply. And you get to the point where your job is more, what do I not say, than what do I say? In other words, to be selective. And the more selective you force yourself into, the better your product's going to be. Don't ever forget it. One other point, and we'll call it quits tonight. I may repeat this several times, but a speaker, I don't care whether he's dealing with a manuscript, and we will deal with this tomorrow night and how it's done, or extemporaneous, or impromptu, a speaker must always keep his eyes on the audience. Called eye contact. You've heard that term. Look them in the eye. Now, Brother Ray, rather jokingly, I think, asked me how I was going to keep him awake tonight. And I said, don't worry. If you fall asleep, I'll keep you awake. And he doesn't know how. He doesn't know that I've got a water pistol back here. Looking at the audience can be very, very effective, not only in terms of enlarging the sense of communication. But if you find somebody wandering, look them right in the eye. Talk right at them. And occasionally, and we'll deal with this tomorrow night, there's another technique to be used carefully. I've used it a couple of times tonight. You haven't even noticed it. But we'll deal with it tomorrow night. But always be aware of the necessity to look your audience in the eye. You're not talking to a vacuum. And remember, we said we didn't have any public speaking if there was no audience. There's no communication if there's no audience. Look them in the eye. Try to look at every one of them. More difficult to do with a manuscript, but we'll tell you how it's done and hopefully help you in being able to do it if you have a problem with it. But remember, never lock yourself to the scripture. Get the Bible open, to the manuscript, to your notes. Never talk to that podium. Never talk to that podium. Always talk to your audience. Whatever your source of internal movement is. Now, that's something that can be practiced. And I mean practiced. You can get so good at it, brethren, that even if you use a manuscript, your audience will not know that you're using a manuscript. But if you're aware now of the public speaking technique, that you must always look at your audience. And when you talk always, if you're dealing with 90%, you're talking always. If you know that, everything that you build in to support that falls almost naturally into place. You force yourself to deal with the mode of your delivery by recognizing that the overriding necessity to maintain maximum communication is to always look at your audience. One of the difficult things to do is if you are, and brethren obviously have this responsibility from time to time, if you have to conduct a funeral. Gil, I just remembered looking at you to make this point, and I think you'll understand what I'm saying. A brother who is conducting a funeral may have the most arduous task going because of the elements. Wind, or rain, or snow. And I've been in all three of them. That is a very difficult time to address your audience in terms of eye contact. It's the maximum difficult situation. But when you are inside a building, there's no excuse. No excuse whatever for a brother not doing it. Now that may sound a little hard, but that's what I meant it to be. Because I want you to remember. I want you to remember. Any questions at this stage of the game? This might be a good point to stop. I don't want to overly do it. We've almost used an hour. Any questions? I see a scowl. Questions?
Yeah. How do you read the manuscript and read it and look at Jordan at the same time?
I will deal with that tomorrow night, Brother Bob, God willing. I will specifically deal with that. Yes, sir.
Why do you feel stepping?
Because if there's any time, remember I said there was two things, it would tend to relax you as the speaker. But there's two things, the other one being the point I think you're addressing. If there is any time during the course of a brother's exhortation or lecture that the audience is going to be looking at him, it's when he first stands up. So if you move, you see, if you move aside, the eyes are going to follow you. That's what I meant when I said you've got them then. They're going to follow you. And when you move back into place, they're going to stay right with you. Whereas if you step up behind that platform and become rigid, it tends to let the audience remove its eyes from you. It's the best time. There's a 5 to 10 second period in there that you can get them that way. You've got to be careful in doing that, but that's what I meant by it.
That's not well in discourse.
No. I said far more at the beginning than you might ever do the rest of your discourse. That's right. There are times when you might want to break the tedium of your own structure and possibly emphasize a point by stepping aside, you see. But we'll get into that with gestures. I saw another hand. Yes, Bob.
Do you
from the very beginning, you get to be all your contention hands on the three little squares of paper that I know he deliberately knocked them on the floor as a attention getter.
Well, very judiciously used, Bob. If he did that deliberately on a repetitive basis, it's lost its impact. Brother Harry last night said something to me, and I'll deal with this again either tomorrow night or Thursday night, said something to me about the way I was handling these papers. I said, well, gee, I'm glad you noticed that, Harry. I did that on purpose. Now, I've already spilled the beans, so to speak, by telling you that, but I will enlarge upon that. That technique, Bob, can be used once effectively. Twice, no. Three times, ridiculous. Very observant individual. Thank you. Thank you, Fred. To illustrate what not to do, Bob. I'm trying to teach a class. Well, I'm succeeding is another question. Yes, but... You mean this?
Yes.
No. I'm glad you're observing it.
You said no movements towards the face, yet you've taken your glasses off 6-8 times.
What I said, Brother Ray, was don't rub your nose or your chin, your mouth. I didn't say not take your glasses off. If the audience recognizes that you're old and feeble, they may go along with it, you see. Any other cynical observations? I'm glad you're listening and watching. That's great. And I'm delighted to see so many of you come out tonight. That's helpful to me. That means that you are motivated with the thought process of improving your situation. That's great. Another question. Yes, Brother Zim.
When you're on the stage,
sneeze. Sneeze.
Sneeze.
Yes, sir. Well, if rubbing your nose keeps you from sneezing, nobody's going to preclude you doing that. The best thing to do is to take a handkerchief out and sneeze into it if you're going to have to sneeze. All your notes go flying. I guess the automatic answer is to sneeze before you get up there. Yeah? Yes, sir. Did you have your hand up? Right. Whoever told you that was giving you very bad advice.
And I just looked at him anyway.
That's good. Good. Yes, Pete.
Using slides.
Yes.
I'm in contact with the people when you put the slide on the screen.
The way I do it, Pete, and the way I would recommend, now this isn't the only way, but if you use a pointer, and most brethren do, in fact, Brother Weller does this quite well. You probably noticed it this morning. He would stand right in front. He'd walk right over in front of that overview. That's the way you do it. You make your point, you see, and then you get in front of it, and you talk. I've done it many times. In fact, I do that regularly when I have to use overviews in terms of my so-called professional work. I will make the point on the overview. I beg your pardon? Yeah, I know what you're talking about. Yes. Block out the picture. Make your point and then stand in front of it. Now, Pete, don't misunderstand me. If, in fact, there's an ongoing proposition on that slide, then obviously you're going to have to make sure that you're off to the side. If the slide is your burden at the moment, obviously you're going to lose eye contact. But then you have to regain it. You regain it a number of ways, either by standing in front of it, which is a very effective way. They're going to be forced to look at you. Or you turn it off and say, now! You see, that's a good time for a gesture and an inflection in your voice. But we can deal with that, too, if we have time. If not, God willing, tomorrow we'll see you. Now, remember, it's the Dauphine Science Building. It's right beside Memorial Auditorium. It's that odd-long building just over the hump there. It's on the far end, room 010. It's the auditorium on the ground floor at the far end. Thank you for being here.